Tonight, a very special tribute to six Coast to Coast guests who are no longer with us. In a moment, a dear friend on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our first special guest, Jim Mars, an award-winning journalist, a dear friend, and an amazing guest. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a great program for you tonight, all hours, all night long. Jim Mars, for the first couple hours, award-winning journalist, more than 30 years experience with several major Texas newspapers. Back in 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, which is amazing. Jim also investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program 3 years before it was publicly acknowledged. He also has produced Alien Agenda, Population Control, Our Occulted History. Jim, how many books do you have out there now?
Oh, gracious, George. I think it's somewhere up close to 10.
Good for you.
The reason I don't seem certain is because some of them have been republished with different titles, and some of them have been, shortened. And I think there's about 10 or 12, but actually probably there's only about 8 or 9.
I just missed you at Contact of the Desert.
I know. I was so mad. I'm sorry. I had a dinner engagement, and I went with other people, and I was kind of stuck. I fully intended to get out there. I had a card that I made for you. I hope you got it.
I didn't get it yet, but they're sending me all the stuff, so I'll get it in a couple days.
Tom will have it for you.
He probably took the money you put inside and took it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. If there's no money in it, Tom got it.
We kept shaking the envelope, Jim, but there was nothing in there. Couldn't find it. How have you been?
I've been pretty good. As you can hear, I'm a pony tonight, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little horse.
A little raspy.
Little raspy, but then that's what happens when you spend a week out in the desert.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Hey, how did you get involved in investigating a secret space program?
Well, number one, I've been hearing about this for a long time, and anytime I hear about something, my journalistic hackles go up, and I go, wait a minute, is that real? Is that right? And, of course, the idea that we have a space fleet somewhere out in space operating, and we don't know about it, and that just does not strike me as being very real, so I really I was paying attention to it, but I did not get actively involved in it until more and more information came out. I think the one thing that really pushed me over the edge was Gary McKinnon, who you may recall.
Mm-hmm. Who hacked into the CIA and NASA.
Computers, yeah. Right. And he was looking for UFO material, and he found the rosters and the duty rosters and the chain of command for a secret space fleet. And he fled to England. I think maybe he's still there, and they're trying to extradite him. And what's really interesting is that the U.S. government, they want him back over here, and they want him on trial, and they want to, put him away somewhere and pipe air to him. And yet the Pentagon itself has admitted that he didn't do any harm to anything.
No.
So why are they so adamant about prosecuting him? And I suspect, and to me, that lends a lot of credence to the idea that there is this secret space fleet.
Well, between him and Edward Snowden, they did a pretty good job getting information, didn't they?
That's right. But you know what, George? I mean, you're right on the cutting edge of it all there with Coast to Coast. And you've heard all the writers and all the investigators, both of them, McKinnon and Snowden. They really didn't tell us anything we didn't already know, right? They just confirmed it.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So tell me what you have heard about this deep space fleet.
Well, basically all I can tell you is, what's floating around, which is that we do have this space fleet out there. I will eventually tell you that I actually finally met a naval officer who told me that he had been out there, and he'd been on these ships. In fact, he said they had given him an operation that allowed him to breathe and to operate in a facility on Venus, if you can believe that.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And but then that leads me to the big question of why exactly do we need a deep space fleet? Does somebody somewhere know something that we don't know?
Is it a fleet to escape?
We're all still here grappling with the idea of, are UFOs real? Are there really aliens somewhere? And yet, so what does it say when there seems to be fairly good evidence that there may indeed be a deep space military presence?
Did this person tell you why we're doing this?
Yes. It's a you remember back during the Cold War, and we had the dew line up in, I think it was Canada, around the Arctic Circle. It was an early warning defense system. My impression is that's the idea. You know, they're out there trying to protect the Earth. But the big question, of course, becomes protect against who or what?
I mean, why would we go to Venus? What are we doing there?
Exactly. Well, and of course, you know, Venus was a new one on me. I'm sure you've already heard the rumblings and the stories about possible bases on the moon.
Yeah.
And maybe even on Mars, you know.
Jim, physicist Stephen Hawking has always warned that we shouldn't be so public out there in the universe, that, you know, if we flag, and he's making an assumption we haven't been visited yet. I think we have, so do you.
Right.
But let's assume, and let's go with what he's been saying, is he doesn't want us to broadcast our location to the rest of the universe. He's concerned.
It's kind of like, you know, don't be careful what you wish for. You might just get it.
That's right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But, you know, he's not the first one to argue against or to warn against. In fact, actually, part of his statements, part of Stephen Hawking's, was that we might find ourselves in contact with a highly advanced civilization who really doesn't care about us one way or another, but they might want our mineral resources.
That's right.
On this planet. And that reminds me, you know, I've been a science fiction fan for years, and I remember back in the early 80s reading this really long, you may recall it, the book about Battlefield Earth. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the storyline in Battlefield Earth is that these aliens, I think they were called Cyclos, you know, they weren't actually mean or bad. They didn't really want to hurt the humans. They just wanted our resources. So they came down here. And as I recall, their invasion lasted 7 minutes.
It's a little like humans pillaging other countries,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes. But can you imagine a worldwide invasion?
7 minutes.
That was accomplished in 7 minutes. I kind of laugh and say, yeah, they must have taken a coffee break.
I mean, do you fear an invasion from space?
Not really. And I'll tell you why. Because, and you know this as well as I do, George, when you look back through history, you find out that there is plenty of evidence to suggest that we have been visited all the way back through our recorded history. I mean, all the way back to the Bible, where you had Ezekiel and the fiery, flaming wheel that went through the air, picked him up, carried him to a city in the mountains, and took him over by the river, you know. It seems real obvious that he was talking about a material object that took him somewhere. And then again, here's the key thing, George. If you'll go and study all of the primitive societies on the earth, from the Hindu Vedas, to the ancient Egyptians, to the ancient Chinese, and their talk about the flying dragons, and the Romans who talked about flying shields. And, you know, the whole history of the world shows that apparently we've been visited all throughout the expansion of humankind. So to me, that's an encouraging thing because, by the way, while I was out in L.A., I guess you noticed that they're getting ready to come out with a second movie.
Independence Day 2, yeah.
You know, where they come down and they blow up everything, they destroy everybody. And again, that's back to Battlefield Earth, where they took over the Earth, and the humans were just about wiped out, and there was just a little handful of survivors that's trying to overcome them. But I don't really fear that right at the moment, because if that was the plan, don't you think they would have done that years ago, when all we had to fight them with was, sticks or swords or something? Why wait until we have deep space fleet and laser weapons and space stations and things like that, you know?
By the way, Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good is out there floating around on Voyager 1 somewhere.
I know. That's why I mentioned that. I wondered if you remembered that.
Jim Marrs with us as we've talked about the secret space program that's out there. Do you have any doubts, Jim, that the program doesn't exist?
I think there's definitely something that exists. You might recall we talked some years ago when my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, came out. And if you'll recall, early on in the space race, there were two distinct space programs. The old Soviet Union was, you know, well, first off, this old Soviet Union and us split the Nazi rocket scientists, right?
That's right.
They got a bunch, we got a bunch, okay? And so the Nazi rocket scientists that went to Russia, they worked on heavy lift rockets that could put big payloads up into space. And that's why that the Russians were the first to put a dog and a satellite into space, an astronaut and a woman astronaut. And that's why we got real perturbed and started really pushing ahead with our space program. Well, what our Nazi rocket scientist worked on was the computer programming, the software that allowed us to plot trajectories and plot orbits and with great accuracy. So, but what's unknown to most people is these Nazi scientists were in touch with each other, and in fact may have been even operating under some very, very highly placed wealthy elite people, you know, the New World Order folks, if you want to call it that. And so what happened, I believe, is that they, at that level, were able to combine the heavy lift rockets of the Russians with the very sophisticated guidance systems of our rockets and then created a secret space fleet. So it's kind of wild, but there's the very real possibility that all these years, while we've been awed by watching those giant rockets take off from Cape Canaveral with, you know, blowing smoke and flame, that somewhere, you know, off over somewhere, maybe the Okefenokee Swamp,
yeah.
You know, they're working, they have alternative spacecraft, possibly even anti-gravity, because right after World War II, there was a lot of very knowledgeable aviation people, including William Lear, that invented the Learjet.
That's right.
Who were talking John's father. About the next generation of anti-gravity craft.
There, it's there. I mean, you know, I know some people at Boeing.
Yeah, you know.
Something's happening there.
Yes.
Something.
Now, you know, you asked me if I'm worried about a big alien invasion, and I said not particularly, because I think they would have done it long before now. But let me tell you what does concern me. If you'll think back, in 2009, on American Idol, of all things, they had Celine Dion sing a duet with Elvis Presley.
Oh, by hologram. That's right.
Right. And the people who were in the audience, and I think you can still find this on YouTube, you go up and watch the tape of it, and it looks like Elvis and Dion are up there singing, you know? So and that was 2009.
Well, they did the same thing with even better technology with Michael Jackson.
Yes, exactly. So, see, we've got that technology, and it's getting, you know, better every year. So what concerns me is a future false flag. You know, all I got to do is make a hologram projection appear over a city, and it would look maybe like a scene from Independence Day where you have a huge craft hanging over the city. You know, people might freak out, and people might say, oh, please, government, you know, take the last of my liberties so you can protect me, you know.
Absolutely. Jim, I want to talk with you about some of your other works as well, and we'll take phone calls next hour from folks who are already starting to call for you. But our occulted history, give me a little synopsis of that.
Oh, yes. Well, now you're getting into the ancient astronauts.
Ah, yes. One of our favorite subjects.
Oh, yeah. But before you do that, I was just reminded, I'll give you a little advanced warning. There's going to be a flying saucer crash on Hollywood Boulevard in about a week.
What's happening there? Oh, to time with the movie?
Yeah, I think it's with the movie, but I think this is why I was reminded of the book of Battlefield Earth. They are launching a republication of that big, thick story, And as I understand it, and I don't have anything to do with it, but as I understand it, I was told by some people they're going to have a saucer or a spaceship crash on Hollywood Boulevard, and they're going to block it off for a while and everything. And so if you see smoke rising up out of the center of Los Angeles, you know, don't freak out. Apparently it's because they are promoting the re-release of Battlefield.
All right, good tip.
Which is a great book, by the way, and kind of a cruddy movie. I don't know what happened to it. I read it years ago, and I think that the problem was, like in so many films, they really didn't follow the book.
Well, this time we'll see what happens. I'm glad you warned us.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, I'll be watching for that. So back to the ancient astronauts. I guess what it boils down to is this, George. You know, you've had plenty of guests other than myself talking about all of the evidence that seems to suggest that we were visited way back in the distant past. Okay, so that just brings up the question, is that true or not? You know, were there ancient astronauts in the past? And if so, where'd they all go? They all leave, or at least some of them still here? Well, I'll tell you, I think that question can be answered. And it can be answered by simply closely studying human history. If, as we are taught in school, it's just been one slow evolutionary climb for humankind from cave dwellers to hunter-gatherers to city-states to empires and nations, then, you know, there shouldn't be anything in the record to detract from that scenario. And yet, as you know as well as anybody, that if you look back, we find reports of sky gods, people flying through the air, advanced beings landing and giving primitive tribes advanced knowledge, reports of, you know, all the way up to UFOs, crop circles, alien abductions, animal mutilation. So, that tells us that somebody's still here.
Sure is. Sure is. Now, why are we concealing it?
Well, okay, first off, the key organizing principle of any society, the one key thing is to provide for the common defense. You know, in the Constitution of the United States, there's actually only two powers delegated to the federal government, and that's to coin and regulate money and provide for the common defense. So, number one, they can't admit that there's something flying through our skies that they not only don't know exactly who they are or what they want, but they can't stop them. So why would we keep spending half our nation's budget on defense when there's no defense? That's one. Second thing is that, let's face it, we're a corporatocracy, you know, or a corporate state. They run this country, the corporations, and they're the people who own these corporations. I don't think they really care, George, whether we know there's aliens out there or not, but what they care about is if the public were to come to a total understanding and knowledge, not just suspicion, but the knowledge that there's advanced technology out there, then it might upset their monopolies over telecommunications and energy and medicine, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's true. There's no question about that. And the Bilderbergs now are going to meet in Dresden, Germany.
Right.
And they talk about all kinds of things. And I'm sure population control is on their list, Jim.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
Because when you get right down to it, they're eugenicists, which means they are concerned with the evolution of the human species and trying to figure out ways to improve it. And speaking of the Bilderbergers, have you ever considered, George, what the mainstream corporate media would do if all of the owners of the National Football League teams were to meet in a hotel and head secretly for a week?
They'd go crazy.
They'd say, that's restraint of trade. That's monopoly. You can't do that.
They'd have live TV vans out there and everything else.
Yeah, but when these corporate world leaders get together, they give them a pass.
Why?
Well, because they're the world and corporate leaders. They're in charge.
Are they afraid of them?
No, they're owned by them. You know, you don't put bad press out about your owner.
Well, that's true, but we get away with it. The corporate elite is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
And badder and badder. That brings me to my latest book, Population Control, How Corporate Owners Are Killing Us.
Jim Mars. I miss him. We'll be back with more special guests in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we recently lost a very dear friend to Coast, the person of music, the music historian, R. Gary Patterson.
Well, welcome back to Coast. You know, I had planned on meeting up, and I still will, June 18th here in St. Louis with R. Gary Patterson. He's going to be part of my live stage show event. We'll talk a little bit about that later on. I did not expect to be talking to R. Gary Patterson until then, and sadly, we must tonight. Gary, of course, is a native Tennessean, a passion for rock and roll. I mentioned some of the books he has written, Take a Walk on the Dark Side, The Walrus Was Paul, Hellhounds on Their Trail. Gary, of course, is the person we turn to during these episodes of music tragedies and other stories. And we'll be talking with him about dead rock stars, The Year of Nine, and, of course, this tragedy that has occurred today, of course, the death of Prince, the rock icon at the age of 57. Gary, this is a sad, sad story.
It's a terribly sad story. I was just thinking tonight, I was walking outside and I was looking up in the sky and I saw all those stars. And I know tomorrow night I'll look up and they'll still be there. But the stars that we've lost this year, I don't think there's anything that's going to be able to replace it, George, because Prince and another of artists, I mean, they're just not favorite bands for you or myself. I mean, these are artists that affect a generation and just not within a few years. So it's been a terrible tragedy for 2016.
TMZ is reporting that there might have been some drugs involved. They're being a little coy about it. But they have talked about it on their sites. What are you hearing?
I'm hearing the same thing, and I mean, I think that's a double tragedy. It's like Shakespeare, you know, the evil that men do lives after them. The good is often tarred with their bones. I'm hoping it's something from the flu, but the more you think about it, you know, it seems more obvious because it seems like that's the one thing that many artists have in common.
Absolutely. You know, that episode, I thought it was kind of strange last week. When merely being just 48 minutes away from his hometown in Minnesota, his plane diverted and had to make a landing quickly in Moline, Illinois, because there was something wrong. He was sick. And the TMZ is reporting that as he was rushed to the hospital, the doctors gave him a shot, because of opiates, drugs. And, of course, his staff says, no, this is just a severe reaction to the flu. And then everybody said he was okay afterwards, and now he's dead.
Even had a party at his house. You know, he didn't perform, but I think he even said, hold on to your prayers for a few days when he got back.
That's right.
And I also heard that he didn't want to stay in the hospital when they pulled him over. Well, I tell you what's funny about it is that they didn't have a room that was a single room. And that was why he left. And that seems kind of odd.
Indeed. Now, didn't he do a song once, Gary, that talked about dying in an elevator?
I think that there was a song about an elevator. I think that the odd thing for me was that he rescheduled some shows in Atlanta, his piano microphone tour, and he did the very last song he played was Purple Rain. And you know, sometimes you're beginning to wonder if you're foreshadowing with some of your lyrics, but he also decided he was going to write his autobiography, and it seemed like he was in a hurry to do it. I'd heard that maybe he had as much as maybe 50 or a little more pages written in it. And if you're really in a hurry to rush your autobiography, does that mean that the end is coming soon, that you feel it?
Well, my publisher's got me writing an autobiography, which is going to be out in about a year, and I trust we're under no rush to get this done, Gary. Jeez.
Hey, I hope so, too. But, George, you're going to be fine. Don't worry.
How do you compare Prince to a superstar like Michael Jackson?
Well, I think they had a lot in common. You know, and I happen to know that Michael Jackson, James Brown, and Prince were all fans of each other. But when you take a look at Prince, here's the thing that gets me. Prince's first release was in 1978. So how many artists have transcended that many years?
Not a lot. McCartney, just a handful.
He was never out of style.
There was a strange juxtaposition of numbers with so many artists. We'll talk about the Club of 27 a little bit later on this hour, Gary. But Prince had a love for the number 7 as well, did he not?
He did. A matter of fact, I guess he was into numerology because of what rock stars are. And when you think of the number 7, a lot of times you think of someone who's a great thinker. And you think of someone who is easily picked out of a group, somebody who may be introverted, but somebody who's highly intelligent. And you read this, maybe you can pick up anything on numerology and make anything fit, but it seems like that. And also, he was very spiritual. And if you take a look at the number 7, I think it has to do biblically, like at the end, like, you know, God created the heavens and the earth, the seventh day he rested. So it's a biblical end to that. And I know that he got very religious it was several years ago, I guess you would say. And mm-hmm. He actually went out and knocked on people's doors and expressed his faith with them. And, you know, when you think about that, you have the spiritual side with him. And then you have, you know, he's got some pretty interesting lyrics that go along with it. But, you know, the whole thing was he was such a talented person. I mean, he played so many instruments. And when we think about George selling 100 million recordings.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
100 million.
And he stayed with the times, digital and everything else, didn't he?
He did. And, you know, look at the songs he played for others. I mean, right now, the top of my head, Nothing Compares to You was a hit by Prince. You had Manic Monday for the, you know, for the, oh my gosh, I'm losing my
oh, that's
voice
right
here, George. That's okay. But you had Manic Monday, and you also had Stand Back by Stevie Nicks. And he played the synthesizer on it. If you listen to it, I mean, Stevie Nicks at that time had never really had any major hits. I know she had Stop Dragging My Heart Around, and she did duets. But if you think about her own hit, that was a pretty impressive song. I still remember the video and remember that synthesizer part. So, I mean, he went out of the park he did songs for other artists. He did cover songs. I remember him, and I think it was 2004 in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where they did a tribute for George, and they did While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And Prince does this incredible guitar solo at the end of it, and that really caught my attention, you know, that he could do that. I've heard a version of him doing All Along the Watchtower, of course, was written by Bob Dylan, but it also had a Hendrix part, but he did it his way. And I think what he was saying is, you know, he could appreciate good music. He could appreciate others' creative talent, and he could just do his own version of it. But when you think about that, he transcended time. He transcended style. You know, you think somebody who's into funk, I mean, he loved James Brown. He loved the dance moves. He loved Michael Jackson. They loved him. They brought him up on stage and did it. So, you know, it's just going to be such a terrible emptiness waiting for something from Prince.
And he was touring a lot lately, wasn't he?
He was touring. Yeah, new albums. All this was coming up.
A lot of energy.
And, you know, what a tragic way to go.
Well, if TMZ is correct, Gary, and it was drugs, it's, again, another tragedy of an icon, a rock figure dabbling in this stuff. Why in God's name do they do this?
I think a lot of times the stress is so high, the ability to get some sleep when they need to sleep, the ability to sort of just get their schedule set up like with Elvis. I mean, it's a tragic thing, and especially if it's an opiate. But, you know, just the idea that you have to have something to get you by. You have to have something to open your eyes and to close them at night and to get by a long airline trip, or worse, you had a long bus ride of 9 to 10 hours at a time. And you know, you don't get any sleep. and you take a look at something that'll help you get by. And unfortunately, that's a lot of it. A lot of rock stars have paid the terrible price.
He was relatively private, wasn't he?
He was very private. And he was very, very protective of his image, and he was very protective of his music. I mean, he fought having his music streamed. He really had issues with his record label. And I remember listening to an interview with him where he said that everybody was indentured servants. And he had his picture made at one time, and written on his cheek, he had written slave, because the record company's on you. And
He fought that, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. You know, and he even left Warner Brothers, his main label, and then he came back. But yeah, he did fight it. I think a lot of artists are fighting it. I mean, if you watched Steve Miller on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame award, he was really tearing down the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, you know, just the idea that the music industry has changed so much, and they're not really turning out all the great artists that you'd normally expect. It's more independent labels. You know, like the big labels are sort of sitting back. So it's kind of sad with that. But Prince had his finger on it. He knew what was happening. And, you know, he wanted to maintain the integrity of his work.
What was that episode? Gary, what was that episode where he changed his name to a symbol?
Oh, the artist formerly as Prince?
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, well, it was weird because at that time, this was against his label, you know, because they had his name.
Okay.
So the artist formerly known. Then he came back as Prince, and he signed the deal with Warner Brothers. So, you know, he was very outspoken. But, number one, he was an artist. And no one can take that away because everyone remembers. I mean, when I think about the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, you know, and recently I think about so many songs that were actually like guideposts in my life, and they always made me feel good, even if they were a sad song. I mean, it was the emotion of it, you know, and just the talent of this one individual. I was thinking earlier, I thought, well, you know, the Beatles, you know, they were a generational band, and I mean, I'm a big Beatles fan, Rolling Stones, everything.
Yes, you are.
But if you take a look from 1963 to 1970s, you know, the Beatles really started pouring it out in 7 years. Now, McCartney is still going strong. But as the band, everything they produced was within 7 or 8 years, and people still love the music. But Prince was able to take the music he had written 40 years before and keep changing it and making it fresh. And a whole new generation grows up and listens to it. That's what makes music last. Well, you grow up, you listen to your mom and dad's records, you decide, I like that, whether it's Frank Sinatra or the Beatles.
Was he generally a soloist, I mean, by himself?
Well, he could play. He put his bands together.
He was a guitarist, right? He played the guitar.
Yeah, he played guitar, but he played keyboards. I think I read he could play up to 12 instruments.
Wow.
So, you know, he was not just one and done. And, you know, he put his bands together, he fronted his bands, he did the vocals, he had the stage moves, he had fashion, he had everything it takes. And the sad thing is, who are going to replace all these guys, you know?
You can't. I don't see a crop coming, you know?
Well, we always got good artists, you know, there's good artists, but there's a thin line between good and great. And who's going to be left in the dustbin of rock and roll history, and who's going to be soaring above it? With Prince, you know, he's soaring above it. And I will tell you today, you know, I was thinking of a lot of his songs, and today I know exactly what he meant when he said, "When Doves Cry," because it was a sad moment. To me, I was in elementary school when John Kennedy was assassinated, but when John Lennon was murdered, it felt like somebody had hit me in the stomach and just knocked the breath out of
him. Oh, my God. I remember Howard Cosell announcing that on a Monday night baseball game.
What a terrible thing. And I hope I'd never have to go through that again. And we've lost a great artist since, you know, many of them. And I felt very saddened. But the beginning of this year, in 2016, it's like I've been hit daily because you never expect it.
No. Where were you? How did you hear about this situation today?
Believe it or not, I got an email. asking me if I had heard that Prince had died. And I was away, wasn't able to get to a radio.
So this was before there was any confirmation?
There was confirmation, because I'm usually tipped off. So my girlfriend wrote me an email and said, Prince is dead, with a question mark and an exclamation.
Yeah, then I started getting text messages.
Yeah, just that text message. And that started it. And then within probably 30 seconds, it was confirmed. And so, you know, I'm just sitting here, I'm saying this can't happen. You know, this isn't real. But, you know, this whole year has been terrible. It's like a serial killer going out stalking the greatest artist we have. And, I mean, have you ever seen anything like it? Now, we can also say, not only in rock music, but Merle Haggard died last week. You have great, like Rickman passed away, who did the Harry Potter things, one of the great actors. And all this has happened since January.
Wasn't there another guitarist who died today?
Well, as you may suggest, yes, you are. You're right. And today, it was a blues guitarist whose name was Lonnie Mack. Now, a lot of people may not know who Lonnie Mack is, but Lonnie Mack did an instrumental version of Chuck Berry's Memphis, and he played this incredible 1958 Gibson Flying V, and he was known for that. Now, not only was he a great instrumentalist, but he influenced Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck. I think Van Halen watched one of his last performances, because he defined the term before it was even used. So Lonnie Mack also died today. And I was thinking, how odd is that? How strange is that? That, you know, you have an innovator or two innovators who passed away today, and someone like Prince, and I can hear his songs in my head all day today, and I'll probably wind up going to bed listening to him tonight after we do the show, because it has such an emotional impact to me still.
This is sad. And as you know, Gary, nowadays 57 is the new 40, and maybe even 35. And Prince had energy. He looked young. I didn't see any signs of drug use or anything whenever I saw him perform. But who would know?
Well, that's true. Who would know? And I guess we'll find out in the next few days. But, you know, it's
we will.
So terrible.
I thought maybe he had a heart attack. I mean, he found the guy in the elevator. I mean, something happened fast.
I could believe a heart attack if he'd had the flu. And, you know, I've seen some things with Prince, some articles. I mean, there was things he was talking about, chemtrails, you know?
Yeah.
And he had brought these things up, stories of Illuminati.
He probably listened to our show. Our Gary Patterson will be back with more.